Yeah, I suppose the launching point for this presentation is that saying of Bante's that the central problem of the spiritual life is finding emotional equivalents for our understanding, because probably all of us have got a pretty good understanding of what the Dharma is about and what one's trying to do, but you've got to really care about it, haven't you? You've got to connect. It's got to matter to you, it seems to me, in order, because it does take quite a lot of effort, a lot of energy, in order to transform oneself, to change one's mental habits. So you need to care about it, I think. And I think that if we're trying to make a real emotional connection with leading a Dharma life, there's no substitute for stories, myths, images, and so on. There are a few people, I think, for whom a sort of pure, as it were, intellectual meditation, I don't mean that in a disparaging sense, but just a pure meditation is enough. But for me, it's not. For me, I need to connect with the Buddha in meditation. And I find I can't connect with the Buddha in meditation just by thinking of him, or just even by recalling his life or his qualities or whatever. It needs to be a bit more than that. And as I said earlier, by the Buddha here, I don't just mean the man who founded Buddhism in a place at a certain date, but something bigger that he represents. And I suppose that's why, for me, I do persist with what people call sadhana. I mean, in a way, sadhana just means your daily meditation practice. I think that's been really helpful. It's been lately clarified in the order. It doesn't mean a particular Tibetan-style visualization. It means your daily practice. And I was reading, I think it's in one of Gunther's comments in this book, you know, Herbert Gunther. So he translated Kindly Bent to Jesus. And I think he says that the meaning of the word sadhana is to become familiar with, is familiarization, the process of familiarization. So I feel that what I need from sadhana or from a daily practice is a regular attempt to connect with what is not me, what is bigger than me, more than me, mysterious at the moment, not completely within my compass of intellectual capabilities, not within my everyday awareness, but also something which is enormously precious, which I feel is very important and precious. Now, if you want to give that a name, my daily practice is on Manjigosha. But in this talk, I thought I'd talk not about Manjigosha, but about three other figures. One of them is Shakyamuni, but Shakyamuni as an archetypal figure, the Shakyamuni of the White Lotus Sutra. The second is Amitabha, because I think in Buddhist history, probably Amitabha, for the biggest number of Buddhists, has been the most prominent actual name given to the Buddha in that sense of what we're connected with. And also something about Maitreya, because there's this mystery of Maitreya as the non-existent Buddha, the future Buddha, a Buddha that's going to happen later. And they seem to be good emblems for this process of connecting. I'll also try to say something about my understanding of Shraddha, because it seems to me that Shraddha is the Buddhist word for imagination, for the imagination that brings emotion and meaning into our spiritual life. So emotion is crucial. And Bante sometimes talked about the distinction between historical truth and mythical truth. Do you remember this? So history is what appeals to the intellect, and myth is what appeals to the emotion. And myth is better than argument at moving the heart. So you might, through history and through argument, you may convince the head, you may convince the thinking side of it, but to touch the heart it's not enough. I mean, I say it's not enough. For some people it is enough, but that's because they immediately turn it into myth, it seems to me. They make it suddenly magical and meaningful. And really good historical novelists are good at doing this, aren't they? As are, you know, some of the sutras about the Buddha. Okay, so Amitabha, I put a little Amitabha figure there on the shrine. Now, as you probably know, Amitabha is the popular Buddha that's usually there very often on the central shrines in East Asian, many East Asian Buddhist temples that follow the Pure Land tradition, which is the most popular type of Buddhism in China and Japan and other East Asian areas. Now, where does Amitabha come from? And if you read the scholars about it, there are these suggestions that Amitabha is a myth, possibly of Iranian origin. So we have this connection between Iran and Buddhist India, and this the sun Buddha. Because you remember, Amitabha is very much associated with the sun, especially the red setting sun. And all the different associations around Amitabha do sort of point to this Iranian origin. But does that really tell you who Amitabha is? And I think this is in the survey. This is what Bhante says. Is Amitabha really just a myth of Iranian origin? What historical evidence is there that Amitabha ever existed as a, you know, historical human figure? So this is the obvious question to ask. But he says, such skepticism fails to take into account the distinction between the empirical truth of reason and the poetic truth of imagination. So this is the interesting question as to whether Amitabha, at least interesting to me, whether Amitabha exists. And when we did that exercise in the meditation of imagining that the Buddha in some form is somewhere sort of present or nearby when you're meditating, well, it had an effect on most people here, I think. So it has an effect. So presumably the definition of something that is real is that it does have an effect. But it's not real in the usual sense. And the obvious distinction here is that there are the class of reality that is discerned by the five senses and the class of reality that is discerned by the mind sense, the sixth sense. So an image is defined as something which is discerned by the mind sense. And there are very many levels of image. There's the level of simple little memories. There's the image of, there's dreams. There are attempts to call people's faces to mind, all that kind of stuff, right up to the grandest and most moving of images. So if it has an effect, then whether it's discerned through the five senses as a physical object in the world outside, which is what the five senses means. The five senses means that which calls into being a world outside. Or whether it's discerned through the mind sense, if it has an effect, then in a sense, it's real. And if it has more of an effect, you could say it's more real. If it's something which is having an effect on a lot of people, like Amitabha, you could say that he's brought into a deeper and deeper reality by that effect on many millions of people over thousands of years. Anyway, to carry on with Bhante's quotation, whether Amitabha did ever live upon the earth as a human being is irrelevant, but what's not only relevant but vitally important is the ideal which the myth, as it were, if it really is a myth, is intending to portray, the spiritual teaching which it imparts. And this spiritual teaching, in the case of Amitabha, of course, is very, you know, is very rich, but it's particularly compassion. Compassion is the big emblem of Amitabha, the message of Amitabha. So through the image, one is trying to learn compassion, and through the myth. So this means that we have these whole branches of Buddhism, these whole schools of Buddhism, the devotional faith-based schools, which are mythical rather than historical in their form. And Abhante goes on later in the survey to say, looking at this myth of Amitabha, Not this world alone, but the whole universe with its background. Only infinite space and infinite time could provide a stage vast enough, a setting sufficiently magnificent for the presentation of the drama of universal emancipation. If we address the intellect, the abstract notion of compassion will serve our purpose. All you need to say is, be compassionate, do it, behave yourself. But if we speak to the heart, compassion needs to be shown revealing itself in a series of concrete acts. And I would also say in image. So we're talking about making a real emotional connection with reading a Dharma life, leading a Dharma life. And this is always connecting with the bigger dimension. And this is what Shraddhar is. So I've talked about the mind sense as being the sense that touches image. But it's interesting, in traditional Buddhism, you probably know that Shraddhar is said to be one of the five faculties, the five indriyas. Now, the word indriya is the same word that is used for the five senses. So there's a conscious connection the Buddha is making between the five faculties, the most important which, or the first of which is Shraddha, and the five senses. What he's saying is the five faculties is how you make contact with the imaginal world, or with the spiritual world, if you want to say that. That's how you discern it through the five faculties, including the other ones, mindfulness, energy, and so on. But Shraddha being the primary one, the first one. So Shraddha is a sense. And it's a sense that detects the possibility of enlightenment. And it sees that possibility, the possibility of enlightenment, in the qualities that people have. But it also sees it in the qualities that the Buddha and the other great, you know, human and non-human figures have as well. And it also, of course, sees the possibility of enlightenment, Shraddha, in oneself. And it sees it in oneself, and then that possibility in oneself is then made more vivid by projecting it outside. And that's the function, it seems to me, if this isn't, maybe this is getting too rational, but this is the function of the mythical Buddha, the mythic Buddha like Amitabha. So you could go too far the other way, it seems to me. You could then say, let's forget about the historical Buddha. This is a Burmese rupa, obviously, of the historical Buddha. Let's forget about the historical Buddha. All you need is a mythic Buddha. But it seems to me that one of the things that you need to bring a myth alive is stories, and stories that have got a quality of everydayness to them and sort of concreteness to them, like many of the stories of the Buddha's life. They can become even more vivid than the grand mythical stories. And it varies from person to person. But yet, when we think of the human Buddha, we also, I would suggest, can remember that the human element is a vehicle for the universal. I think this is the way that Lama Govinda puts it. It's another book I brought along, which on this whole area I think is one of the most stimulating books to read, is this book by Lama Govinda called Creative Meditation. Creative Meditation and Multidimensional Consciousness by Lama Anagarika Govinda. And Bhante quotes Govinda in the survey. He says, more is known and said about the Buddha's spiritual lineage in the text we've come down to us than about his descent, than about his human descent. You don't know all that much about his parents and grandparents and so on. And this shows clearly that his spiritual lineage, which might rightly be called his universal background, was regarded as being far more important than the historical and material one, that is, to the early Buddhists. That's what they really thought it was important to convey, was where he came from in a cosmic sense, talking about Dipankara and all that kind of thing. So thus the human life of the Buddha must be seen in an entirely different perspective. It becomes a mere fraction of a far bigger and more important development in which the human element is essentially the vehicle for the rediscovery of the universal or transcendental character of mind and consciousness. So the human element is essentially the vehicle for rediscovering the universal character of consciousness. Does that sort of make some sort of sense? So when we think of the Buddha, when we bring the Buddha to mind, we're looking through the Buddha to something which is vast, which is universal, which is enlightenment as a possibility. I mean, this is all fairly old hat. I'm sure you're aware of this kind of thing. And of course, a real human being has many, many imperfections, including the Buddha. He gets old, he ages, he forgets things, he makes mistakes, he gets fed up, maybe. He can only walk so far. He's restricted in time. He's found in a particular time. He's no longer with us. He's found in a particular place. He can only contact a certain number of people in his lifetime. There are limits to that. He's limited by the language he's speaking. He's limited by his particular temperament, so he's going to appeal more to some than to others. And also, the biggest failing of all is that he dies. This disgraceful thing the Buddha did. He's no longer around. Although we can imagine that he is. So when we go for refuge to the Buddha, you could say that we're not really going for refuge to the historical Buddha because he's now dead, he's no longer there. So in the survey says, Gautama the Buddha is dead and gone. In what then shall we take refuge if not in the indestructible essence of Buddhahood, the universal possibility of being enlightened, which is always there for whenever there's consciousness, that is a real possibility. So in order to contact the ideal, to go for refuge, you need the mythic. This is the suggestion. So this is looking at the Buddha in a particular way, as the principle of enlightenment, rather than as an Indian man. So you could say he is, in this sense, he is awakeness. Full awareness, with no barriers at all. Full awakeness, that's what he represents. And this is the principle that Shraddha, this faculty, this sense, of Shraddha, or imagination, if you like, senses. That's what you sort of sense. And you can only really sense it. You can't grasp it fully. You can't delineate it fully. You might be able to have a lot of detail about the Buddha, his historical figure. You know, I mean, if it was an enlightened person who's living today or lived in the recent past, you might have photographs and a full life story, all that kind of thing. But the principle of enlightenment, you can just sense it, and it depends on how well developed your Shraddha is as to how vividly you'll be able to sense it. So how do you do this? And it seems to me that the way you do this is to you look for it all the time. So you look for awakeness or unbounded awareness in every experience, in every moment, if you can remember to do so. You do it in your meditation, but you do it when you meet another person. You look for the Buddha that's there in that person. Or you meet it when you're in nature. People were talking about nature earlier as their way. You meet it when you look up at the sky. You meet it when you hear of courageous acts by people, and so on and so on, many ways. You meet it when you just look into somebody's eyes and you realize there is awareness there that one is not able to be present in. You realize, I've met awakening a little bit, an element of it at least. So in that sense, because it's always potentially accessible, awakeness, it means it is here now. So it means that when you do a meditation where you imagine the Buddha was present, you're not fooling yourself. In that sense, the Buddha is, in the sense of the historical figure, of course he's not present, he's dead, he's buried, he's rotted. But in the sense of the principle of enlightenment, he actually is there. It's true that he's there. It's not just a religious thing to say, or a sort of a pious thing to say, or isn't it wonderful how sort of devotional this person is, or something. It's actually true. Awakeness is always present, I would suggest. And this is, in a way, one of the themes of the White Lotus Sutra. So, just to remind you again, I'm sure you've all studied it, you know, the White Lotus Sutra, but you remember one of the central themes of the White Lotus Sutra is the Buddha revealing that he's always been around and always is around. But this is not the historical Buddha. This is the Shakyamuni eternally teaching the Lotus Sutra on the Vulture's Peak. And so the Buddha there is actually making an explicit statement, saying, "You think you're looking at me as a human being. I'm not the Buddha, really. The Buddha is really the eternal principle of enlightenment. And this is what he says in the White Lotus Sutra. Since I attained Buddhahood, which of course, according to the literal historical truth, was about 40 years previously. But no, he says, no, that's wrong. Since I attained Buddhahood, the kalpas through which I passed are infinite thousands of myriads of kotis of Asankhya years. Infinite thousands, myriads of kotis of Asankhya years. That's quite a lot. Ceaselessly preached I the Dharma. So he never stopped teaching. And taught countless kotis of creatures to enter the way of the Buddha. Since then are unmeasured kalpas. Then I, with all the Sangha, appear together on the divine vulture's peak. And then I tell all creatures that I exist forever in the world. If in other regions there are beings reverent and with Shraddha aspiring, again, I'm there in their midst to preach the supreme Dharma. You, not having heard of this, only say that I have died. But I behold all living creatures sunk in the sea of suffering. Hence I don't reveal myself, but I set them aspiring till when their hearts are longing, I appear to preach the Dharma. In such supernaturally pervading power, throughout Asankhya Kalpas, I am always on the divine vulture's peak and in every other dwelling place. So that's that last line is a little shock, isn't it? It's like, oh, we're imagining the White Lotus Sutra happening on the vulture's peak in India, or the sort of imaginary equivalent of that on this great realm. But he also says, I'm everywhere else as well. Don't forget that. I am with you when you're meditating. So this is another, I don't know how much time I've got really to go into this, but of course there's that thing about him saying in the White Lotus Sutra that in a way the Buddha's historical life is a sort of a game of skillful means. So he appears to die. And the reason he appears to die, he said, is if it was really obvious that the Buddha was always around, he would get taken for granted. You need longing. You need aspiration. You need, in a sense, you need to feel that the Buddha is a bit inaccessible, a bit difficult to find, and not too obviously there sitting with you while you meditate, because you need to feel the lack somehow. This is a very interesting error, I think. I mean, I don't mean that literally means, you mustn't take all this literally, that the Buddha, of course, never really died or something like that. The human form of the Buddha did die, but of course this eternal principle of enlightenment doesn't. It is always there, but yet it's sometimes really difficult to stay aware of it. And so the response to that difficulty, the Buddha in the White Lotus Sutra is suggesting, is for you to arouse a sense of longing. Think, oh, I wish the Buddha could be around more. I wish I could see the Buddha. I'm really going to put some effort in. I'm really going to sit there and sort of try and imagine him and get as much as I can. And wouldn't that be wonderful? And then he'll become more vivid and more present and so on. And then when you do see him, you'll be able to take full advantage. And also you'll see him not just as an ordinary Indian person, but in bright, visionary, clear, colourful, non-everyday sort of way. And I think a lot of people get this sense, at least sometimes, if they do feel a connection with a mythic figure in Buddhism, whether it's the Buddha himself or another one, they do have that sense of them being in a way always there. So I talked to one older member whose practice was Pranyaparamita, and she said she feels that Pranyaparamita is perpetually there. He represents the patience behind existence. The Buddha can't make you enlightened. The Buddhas just sit with the truth, but eventually people will perceive it. And then we could go into the difference between Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. But I'm not going to do that for now. You know, again, that Bhante's talked about the Buddha, the Bodhisattvas as being this process, and the Buddhas as being this sort of eternal presence. So, where, you know, we're saying the Buddha's always here, but where actually is he? You know, when you look around, do you find him? And there are a number of approaches to this. You know, we've gone into this using the imagination. But another approach I want to mention is the Diamond Sutra approach, which is to realize that the Dharma is the real Buddha. but the Dharma maybe in its broadest sense. In fact, it's not just the Diamond Sutra, because if you go back to the Pali Canon, you remember the story of Vakali, who says, he says to Vakali, when Vakali says, "Oh, I wish I wasn't so old and I could get to see you more often." And the Buddha says, "He who sees the Dharma sees me. He who sees me sees the Dharma." And I guess it's out of that saying that the Diamond Sutra arises. So you remember in the Diamond Sutra, this is what it says. This is the Buddha speaking again, or a Buddha, or the archetypal Buddha speaking. "Those who by my form did see me, those who followed me by voice, wrong the efforts they engaged in. Me, those people will not see. From the Dharma one should see the Buddha. From the Dharma bodies comes their guidance. Yet the Dharma's true nature cannot be discerned, and no one can be conscious of it as an object." So the Diamond Sutra, of course, is very careful that you don't take that literally. You can't be conscious of the Dharma as an object, but yet the Dharma is the only way you can really see the Buddha, through seeing the Dharma. So this means that the historical Gautama is not the Buddha. He's saying it is not the Buddha. We made a big mistake. We thought he was the Buddha, but he's not really. So who is the Buddha? Well, the Dharma, I suppose, as teachings, maybe that would be enough to say the Dharma in the sense of all the teachings of Buddhism, that's the Buddha. That's, you discern the Buddha by looking at the Dharma. But there's another way of looking at the Dharma. The Dharma, of course, means dharmas, in other words, qualities, in other words, Buddha dharmas, which means the qualities of the Buddha. Buddha dharmas means the qualities of the Buddha. So we list all these qualities and we look for them in people, we look for compassion, we look for wisdom, we look for freedom and so on. And the Dharmakaya then is defined, the Dharmakaya, the Dharma body, is said to be a pure stream of dharmas, a pure stream of transcendental dharmas. So therefore it's reality. So that's another way to look at it. They're all just angles, aren't they? You know, so we could say we see the Buddha by seeing reality. That's how you see the Buddha, the Dharma in the sense of reality. And I suppose that's the most exalted meaning of the word Buddha, the reality as a whole. And the human, the Buddha as a human, is just one mode of discerning reality. So we do discern reality by discerning the Buddha, but we must remember that doesn't sum it up by any means. So again, going back to Bhante's quote in the survey, "The historical personality of the Buddha is the particular mode in which unenlightened gods and men perceive the transcendental, compassionate activity of the Absolute." So the historical personality of the Buddha is the particular mode in which unenlightened gods and men, like us, perceive the transcendental, compassionate activity of the Absolute. But not God, of course. Remember, I mean, again, we could take it too literally and think that means a deity. But this is not a creator, this is not a judge, this is not even a person. So again, I've talked a little bit about how we can catch hold of that imaginative version of the Buddha in everyday life, in seeing it in everyday life. But there's also practice as well. There's also more conscious, deliberate practice where we're trying to do it. And there we might be evoking the qualities of the Buddha, bringing in the myths as well. So if you add the qualities of the Buddha to all the myths about the Buddha, what you then get, in technical terms, is the Sambhogakaya. So I've talked about the Dharmakaya, the Buddha as reality. But if we add qualities and myths together, we get the Sambhogakaya. And that's the Buddha who's teaching the White Lotus Sutra, but it's also Amitabha, it's also Maitreya, and whatever. And this is visionary tokens of Buddhahood so far unreached in us. And these proliferate, these visionary tokens proliferate into all the different jinnas, all the different bodhisattvas, representing different qualities or highlighting different qualities. They originate, people tell us, in meditative visions. You know, people have been in deep meditation, they've met these figures, they've met aspects of the Sambhogakaya, and then they transmit those to their disciples. They become tankas, they become stories, they become a drama, because if you do a sadhana, it always has a dramatic element to it. The principle of enlightenment becoming apparent to your imagination. The principle of enlightenment becoming clear and present in your imagination. So this is bringing us back to the Buddha as an object, and then to the Buddha as our sense of him as a presence in our imagination. And this is something we need. We need this, the grandeur of that, I think. At least not all of us need it, maybe, but a lot of us need it. I do. So how do you, again, in your practice, how do you make this more alive, more vivid? And again, I'm sure you know your own ways of doing it. There are many ways of doing it. But you do need to realise that not everyone does it the same way. And I think it can be just so stifling if you feel that you have to follow the model of somebody else, even somebody you have a lot of respect for, like Bhante or something, in how one makes this connection. You have to find it for yourself, don't you? Surely you do. So see what you go for. See what you care about. See what areas of the arts you go for example, and find that as a way through. See what voices you go for, what, you know, descriptions that people give you. Do you go for traditional stuff? If so, maybe it's for some people it's the Chinese, for some people it's the old Gandharan, maybe for some people it's Tibetan and so on. You know, just find out what you go for. But then actually do something active, I would suggest. Look for the colour, look for the brightness. Maybe make drawings in the visual. Maybe, you know, chant mantras, make tunes for mantras. Find occasions when you can do it. Look for beauty, look for symmetry. Make shrines if you want to, if that helps. Have pictures. But also find it in space as well. In visualization practice, perhaps, the drama of recollecting the Buddha. And just in brief, you know, to look at the principle, there's a lot in here about the principles of visualization practice, the drama and how it works, and there are other quite interesting books about that. And I'm not sure I quite got to grips with it myself, but you do go through a process when you do a so-called visualization practice, a sadhana in the sense. It does have a dramatic form to it. It needs to start with mindfulness, as everything does, but then it needs to go into commitment. It needs to go into you reminding yourself of the direction that you have in your life, which is marked by going for refuge. But then that commitment needs to expand into a compassionate engagement. So quite often you'll have a recitation of the Bodhisattva vows or some equivalent, or the Brahma Viharas at that point, where you have a sense of, this is not to do with me, this is to do with everybody and me really caring about everybody. And then you'll have the solidity of your experience starting to dissolve, and so you will generate a blue sky. You'll generate a blue sky by realizing every single element of this flow of your experience is just arising and passing away, arising and passing away, arising and passing away all the time. And so you can let it arise and pass away, and then you'll experience spaciousness of the blue sky. And the blue sky is not a sky, it's not even space. These are both Western terms which don't sum it up. It is Akasha. When you were given your name, Akasha Mitra, what did they say about Akasha?
It was related to space, but as a kind of an inner concept. So space externally being a sort of a metaphor for the internal space that opens up.
So it's the internal space, or as it were internal.
Yeah. It's all the unity between external and internal, if that makes sense. Yeah.
So whenever you have an experience, for example, if you call something to mind, even another person's face, where does that happen? It happens in a space, and we can call that space our mind. So Akasha is the mind. Akasha is the spaciousness in which things happen. And also the root of Akasha means shining. So it's not space in the sense of blackness between stars. It's space in the sense of constant illumination, the illumination of awareness. So it's a space in which awareness is present. So you've always got because we are dualistic, you've always got two elements to things. You've got the element of the appearance and the space, the akasha. So when you do a sadhana practice, in some sense, you're bringing something into being, something, you know, definite, with colour to it maybe, and shape to it and so on, but it's happening within this illuminated, aware space, which is what akasha is. And this is the same as when the Heart Sutra talks about form and emptiness. And it's also related to our own experience of object and subject. So the indefinable non-self me is akasha, is the mind. And it's spacious, it's empty, everything can arise in it. And the appearances that arise, the appearances, are what seem to be not me. They seem to be things that I'm bringing into my becoming aware of with my mind sense or with my Shraddha or whatever you want to call it. So this is what happens. This is why you first of all conjure up blue sky, in other words, akasha. You notice the akasha. You can't visualize akasha. You just sort of notice it, the spaciousness. And then it may be then you do whatever it is you do in your practice. And there may be lots of things that happen. There may be, you know, a figure appearing. Maybe they get anointed. Maybe light comes from them to you. The mantra starts up. And then eventually, in some sense, unity will be achieved. Because this is dualistic. You know, you've got space and you've got the appearances. In some sense, unity will be achieved. Maybe, maybe by them as a visualized figure being absorbed into you. And you've remembered that they've appeared out of the akasha. They're not solid in any sense. They're not historical. It may be that everything, including you, just vanishes into the akasha, and all you're left with is akasha. It may be, you know, there's lots of things that can happen. And then maybe you have some verses at the end which dedicate your merits and dedicate it and so on. So it's a drama. Other ways in which you may be able to... So sadhana may work for you as a way to connect with the grandeur of Buddhahood, of the eternal Buddha or whatever. It might be stories. Maybe you could write a story, write a narrative about it, bringing excitement to bear on it. It might be dreams. It might be that significant dreams, by recalling them, that's the way you connect, whether or not they include the Buddha literally. It might be the Mahayana approach of size and power, vast numbers, the cosmos with all sorts of extraordinary things happening. And through that magic, a sense of magic. It might be the specific pantheon of Buddhism, especially the Mandala of the Five Jhanas, and as I'll be saying later, Maitreya as well. So I just want to... I brought in the Five Jhanas just because it seems to me that they show us that the Buddha appears in all sorts of forms, in an array of forms, in a mandala of forms. So the mandala, I think, is crucial for this. The mandala tells us that it's never enough, in a way, just to have one form for the Buddha, because it's likely to become one-sided. So at least in the back of our minds, we remember that, well, this is my own feeling, my own evocation of them in my own mind, that when we look to the east, the place of the rising sun, we see a blue Buddha who's a mountain covered with waterfalls. If we look over to the south, let's move right over from the east to the west, and that's where we see a red Buddha. In front of the sun as it sets, and behind, setting behind the islands in the Western Ocean. Somehow, well, the Amitabha, of course, is associated with the ocean, with the Western Ocean. and those islands there in the sunset. And I want to come back to that particular image of Amitabha at the very end. And then the green Buddha in the north, for I see at least, as a forest full of bright birds, and the bright birds in the forest are seen to be the living garment of an enormous Buddha. And then in the south, I see a solid gold Buddha. And from the hand of the solid gold Buddha, there is a sort of a liquid flow of kindness and regard. And then finally, in the centre, but not in the centre, in the middle, but actually up, is this dazzling white Buddha residing above the clouds, but also residing in the Akasha. The Akasha is the abode of Varochana in particular, isn't it? So if you think of the blue sky, the thing about the sky is that, and this is physically true, every cell, they call it, the cell of the density fluctuations in the atmosphere, is itself a source of radiance. That's why the sky is blue. The blueness doesn't come from a place. It comes from within the whole of the atmosphere. So I think that's a wonderful symbol for Akasha, the scientific reality of the blue sky, and of Varochana as well, I think. I can't actually remember why I wanted to talk about Maitreya, but it seemed to me that it's not enough just to look through the jhanas. This may be too much already. We looked at Shakyamuni, the mythic Shakyamuni of the White Lotus Sutra. We've looked at the great array of figures represented by the mandala of the jhanas and all the associated figures with them. But somehow there is another dimension to bring in, which is, in a way, the non-existent Buddha. And I see Maitreya as, in a sense, being the non-existent Buddha. But there's also something else about Maitreya. After all, his name means the loving one, which is the contrast between Shakyamuni and Maitreya. So Shakyamuni specializes in wisdom. Shakyamuni is the great teacher. He's the great founder of the Dharma. He worked out the whole of the Dharma, or the basics of it, at least many other people have contributed. And so his role as a teacher is more important than his enlightenment, in the case of the Buddha. It's more far-reaching, has more effect, more than his own liberation of himself. That was a fantastic achievement, but relatively trivial compared with the fact that he taught, that he had the wisdom to be able to translate it into words and teachings. So we need these. We need specific teachings, at least, again, most of us do. Not just a little thing says, oh, by the way, somebody once gained enlightenment, and here's a picture of them. You actually need something more than that. You need teachings. You need advice, not just an exemplar of love, which is what Maitreya is. Maitreya would be useless as the Buddha founding Buddhism. Because he's love, not wisdom. You need a body of subtle dharma. You need a system of practice that can reach into the future from Shakyamuni. That's what he's doing. He speaks to the future. Now, Maitreya is speaking not to the future, but to the past. In other words, to his past. I don't know where I've got all this stuff from. It may be a lot of nonsense, but somehow it feels to me like you've got Maitreya there in the future. He's a myth of the next Buddha when we've forgotten about Buddhism completely. But yet, he speaks to us. There's a voice coming from the future, at least within the myth, within the story of Maitreya. So a Buddha of love can't be historical. Has to be a mythic figure, an image which engages with our imagination, it seems to me. You did get this element coming into Shakyamuni in the Mahayana, where the compassion of Shakyamuni was more and more emphasized or re-emphasized, the example of compassion in his life. So a loving Buddha who's not very good at the Dharma, or not so good at the Dharma, can't achieve very much unless he's lucky and has lots of very good disciples. And this makes me feel, this in a way, for me, I'm sorry to say this, but this is the failure of Christianity. That Christianity is founded by a loving figure. So it's fantastic. I mean, it's very positive. I don't have anything against that. You've got an emblem of love, although there are some bits of Christ that are not so loving, but let's ignore those for now. You've got a strong emblem of love, but crap Dharma. To be frank, You know, no really good systematic teachings of how you work on yourself and how you practice. The poor guy only taught for 3 years, and he was very unlucky in his, it seems to me, in the people that wrote down his sayings. They couldn't even agree amongst each other about what the basic points were. And they got obsessed with things like, you know, Jewish prophecies and things, you know, or kowtowing to the Romans. And anyway, let's not go into that. But I think this is the... I mean, obviously Christianity has been successful, but not successful in getting people enlightened. It's been politically successful, in a way culturally successful and having a big influence. But if you want to actually get people enlightened, which surely is the important thing from a Buddhist point of view, you need a Buddha like Shakyamuni who has the time and the ability to really set forward a Dharma. So the Christ figure in Buddhism can be moved into the future, and you get love speaking to you from the future somehow. This is not very formed in my mind, but there's something going on like that. A Buddha of the future needs to be, perhaps, a Buddha of love. I've got one more quote here about Amitabha as the mythic Buddha. To his worshippers, Amitabha is not one Buddha among many. This is again from Bhante in the survey. Not even the first among equals, but Buddhahood itself, in the most beautiful and adorable form conceivable by the heart of man. He was wisdom and compassion not only in their fullness, but in their overflowingness. He's the most highly transcendent and the most deeply immanent. Immanent meaning, you know, hidden and emerging or potential. In him, absolute reality manifests as the supreme beauty out of infinite love. Upon him, therefore, gradually centered all the rays of devotion which hitherto had been dispersed over a multitude of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, until he had become the dazzling focus of the love and the adoration of millions of Far Eastern Buddhist hearts. So somehow, Amitabha was able to offer something that maybe wasn't being offered by Shakyamuni as a historical figure, by being so vast and by being the focus of so much devotion, by representing beauty, by representing compassion. So whether it's Amitabha, whether it's Shakyamuni, whether it's the historical Shakyamuni or the mythic Shakyamuni, whether it's Maitreya, whatever it is that grabs you, it seems to me, to sum up, the mythic Buddha, to be really useful, needs to be starting to appear in all our experiences, all our life. So we need to help this to happen. We need to find that in our meditation, in nature, in other people, in art and music, in particular practices like visualization, in pujas. I haven't talked about that, the collective practice of bringing the mythic to life in puja, and we'll finish today with a puja. In festivals, going along, appreciating them, enjoying them, celebrating. And so what I've been trying to convey in this talk is that if you want to be motivated to continue on the hardest but most rewarding of all journeys, which is what the Dharma is, I think, then your emotions need to be awakened. Particularly Shraddha needs to be awakened, which is like a sense that detects what is beyond your present experience, what is bigger and more important. For most people, that beyond is best conveyed in grand stories, myths, and the image of the Buddha or of Buddhas, not confined by space and time, not historical. And these Buddhas are moulded by the amazing array of superlative qualities that make up enlightenment, love, clarity, compassion, wisdom, and so on. One example is Maitreya, another is Amitabha, the Red Buddha. The Red Buddha who's only hidden from us because the sun is so bright that we can't, if the sun wasn't so bright, there he'd be. We'd see his image, which is what Bhante did, I think, when he had that vision when he was in the cave. And he had a sense of next to the sun, Amitabha, and that road of light that comes across the sea from Amitabha to us. So I wanted to finish with a poem about him. When I was on the west coast of Scotland, looking out over the Atlantic, where you can see some of the islands, and you can see the sun setting. It's that it's the, I don't know, for me, the west coast of Scotland is the place of Amitabha. The place to go if you want to meet Amitabha. Go up there and sit. Occasionally the sun does appear and you can watch it setting over the sea, over the Atlantic. And this red road of light from the horizon to oneself. So it seems that road seemed to me to symbolise the path that one is taking. You want to sort of walk out onto the sea and move towards Amitabha out there. And once when I was there, I could actually see shoals of fish moving in the water. So you had the water glittering with this ruby light from the sun, and you could see shoals of fish. And so this poem tries to convey that experience, and I'll finish with that. And then we can have some responses or thoughts that you may have. There is a red road that the mackerel cross and dash across. And a man who is not a man, touching his back to the sky, shows me his red flower, become detached from a liquid sun. A high arch of dazzling mist is building over the red road. His smooth forearm shakes the sound of a smile in drops to melt away the bridge. So the road runs on, and the sunset rises. Forget this beach in Scotland. America is a pebble in the road. My eye is liquid with red love, yet forgets itself before a huge knowing. Dripping light telling, flower knowing for me. That twilight need not fall again. The mackerel cross and dash across. Always the red road. Thanks.